Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Western Bubble. I am Dario, and I'm here with Balder. And in today's episode, we're going to talk about Haiti. Balder, why are we speaking about Haiti, such a small island that is not really within the West?
That's a very good question, Dario, especially because I'm a bit nervous since Haiti is very far away from my area of specialization. It's certainly not a country whose history I know particularly well. But we're talking about Haiti for two reasons. The most direct reason is that it's in the news again because there's now a transitional government after already 3 decades of enormous hardship for the local population because of political instability and economic and natural disaster. And secondly, because it is a very good example of how the West has been responsible for a lot of these disasters, a lot of these problems. And it's an example of how you can see the inability of the West to actually make it right, to make it better. So it is a good case study for our Western bubble.
And what are the facts?
Haiti, officially the Republic of Haiti, is a country on the island of Hispaniola in the Caribbean Sea, east of Cuba and Jamaica, and south of the Bahamas. It occupies the western third of the island, which it shares with the Dominican Republic. Haiti is the third largest country in the Caribbean and has an estimated population of 11.4 million people, making it the most populous Caribbean country. The island has been inhabited since about 5000 BC by groups of Native Americans thought to have arrived from Central and South America. On December 6th in 1492, Christopher Columbus landed on the island, claiming it for the crown of Spain and bringing endemic Eurasian infectious diseases, causing epidemics that killed a large number of native people. As the Spanish refocused their colonization efforts on the greater riches of mainland, Central and South America, they gave up the western third of the island on which French colonists settled the area known today as Haiti. In the midst of the French Revolution, the oppressed population of Haiti launched the Haitian Revolution, defeating Napoleon's forces and declaring Haiti's sovereignty on January 1st of 1804. Haiti's first century of independence was characterized by political instability, payment of crippling debt to France, and the vast costs of the war and the occupation of Santo Domingo, the rest of the island. Political instability and foreign economic influence prompted the United States to occupy the country between 1915 and 1934. In 2004, the country went through another coup d'etat, which prompted UN intervention. In 2010, the island suffered from a catastrophic earthquake that killed over 250,000 people. The name Haiti comes from the indigenous Taino language and means land of high mountains. It was the native name for the entire island of Hispaniola until colonization.
What is the bubble?
When we're talking about Haiti, so I just gave a very, very brief history, right? To the listeners who are maybe expecting a deep dive into Haiti and what are its problems, I must disappoint you. This is not the place. If you're interested in that, we can recommend Haitian podcasts on this, right? On the history of it. Please listen to them if you want to have a deep dive. For us, as always, we're going to mainly focus on the Western bubble aspect of this entire situation in Haiti. And one of the first things is that Haiti, as we know today, is a European construct, right? Nothing of its original being from the day before the 6th of December of 1492 is left.
And never say nothing, but very little at least. And if you look at the demographics, it is a combination of mostly European and some Arab blood together with Africans who were brought there by the Europeans through slave trade. So the current makeup of Haiti, unlike, for example, larger countries in Latin America, such as Peru, where you still have significant indigenous populations, the current makeup in Haiti is very much the direct consequence of this European intervention, this European colonialism and centuries of oppression.
Because the country, since its discovery by Europe was never really left alone by it, right? So first you have the Spanish, then you have the French, then you have the somewhat European United States intervening and meddling in its affairs since 1492. The country was never left alone.
No, and what is very interesting always about the Caribbean, South America, as opposed to, for example, the North American experience, at least the United States experience, is that even when technically countries became independent at the beginning of the 19th century, in the case of Haiti, 1804, they inherited a legacy of European structures, right? So even though they were nominally in charge of their own destiny from that moment on, they were given a political system that was already antiquated in Europe that they now had to adapt to their own realities. And that makes it stand apart from, for example, the United States, which said, we are going to reject all those European ways, political systems and ways of doing things, and we're going to create our own project. We're going to do Europe 2.0. In the case of Haiti and a lot of Latin American countries, it was very much an experience of basically trying to cope with badly formed European political structures.
Mm. And this process of coping with your traumatic history, right, that first sees the majority of the native population wiped out, replaced with slaves from the African continent, and then kind of torn apart by multiple wars, because you not only do you have basically a French colony on there, no, on the entire island you have a French and a Spanish colony, which also are, there's a lot of fighting between the two of them over the hundreds of years. So you have these traumatic experiences, and then, I mean, it's difficult to go through that process of basically dealing with that trauma and then building something new upon it. And in Haiti, that never happened.
Yeah, it's history reverberating into the present, right? It is this idea that all the complexity and all the trauma from the past, if it's not properly dealt with, will always be a burden to your present ability to create productive, constructive political systems, sociological tendencies, etc., etc. There has been some really interesting studies as well about the impact, for example, of the slave trade on East Africa, which was like Zanzibar, an island, which was the center of slave trade between Asia, Africa, and Europe for a long time, and how that for a very long time afterwards still continues to reverberate in the psychology and the sociology of the people on the island and around it. In many ways, you could kind of compare this to an individual, right? If you've been abused in your childhood, or you've got a very traumatic past, then unless you can deal with that with good therapy or with good support mechanisms, you're going to always suffer throughout the rest of your life. And then if those abusers come back once in a while to say hello, that makes it even worse, right? So that individual experience of trauma that needs to be healed before you can move on also applies to a country like Haiti.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, if we're on the individual level, I would compare if I had to compare the West to an individual in this specific case with Haiti, right? It's almost like an addict who's saying, oh no, I know I failed Haiti already 8 times, but this time I can fix it, instead of just staying away. And this seems to be the case with the West, because every time, I mean, we now hear about Haiti. And so Haiti is, for me, one of the first big news items that I can very vividly remember from kind of first consuming news, right? So the earthquake in 2010. And since 2010, the situation has not gotten any better, right? You had the cholera outbreak, you had United peacekeeping missions, then you had a horrific weather events basically in 2016, and then you have all the political instability. And every time you hear one of these negative news items about Haiti, there's this reflex everywhere within Western media, but also among Western policymakers, of talking about any form of intervention, right? And if it's not talking about a direct military intervention, we're talking about a Or, you know, maybe we'll just help them a little bit with their police force intervention.
Yeah, and I like the analogy of an addict because the first thing you have to do as an addict, if you want to overcome your addictive past, is to recognize that you've got a problem, right? You have to be able to say, I am in need of help. I am addicted to something and I need to fight that addiction. Europeans or the West in general have never really come to terms with the fact that they've been abusers in the past, that they've been bad in the past, that they've had negative impact. Sure, they know a little bit about it, but they've never fully recognized it. It's like me saying, oh yeah, no, I do drink sometimes a little bit too much, instead of acknowledging that I'm a true alcoholic, right? By the way, for the record, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't drink alcohol, but the problem is exactly this for Europe, that because they've never come to grips with the destructive nature of their own past, they find it almost impossible to recognize their destructive presence right now in 2024 or over the past few decades. And so they don't understand why their presence in Haiti and other countries is counterproductive, is destructive.
Yeah, no, not at all. And again, I feel like we have now reached a point in the West where usually when someone talks about intervention, there's a bit more of a hesitant reaction, right? It was like, oh, we've done it a few times in the past, let's not. With Haiti, that's not the case, right? And I assume this has to do something with size. I mean, also maybe proximity to the United States, right? It's, oh, here we're talking about a small island. I mean, yes, 11 million people living there, that's a big number. But okay, we can help that. I mean, this is not the same as Afghanistan, right?
No, and then maybe more aptly in when we stick to the region, Haiti is not the same as Brazil or Argentina or Colombia, which are so sizable that they have to be dealt with differently. The small size of the island, together with the very strategic location of the island and the proximity to the United States in particular, of course, mean that the West have a very easy time trying to influence the country and trying to shape the country in their own image. Now, key word here, trying to shape, they find it easy to try to do it. They never manage to do it, obviously, because it's unnatural for Haiti to be the recipient of this imposition from abroad, which is exactly the problem of the Western bubble in general. The West cannot project its identity onto the rest of the world, even if it wanted to. But the United States and European countries have over and over again tried to interfere with Haitian politics, with Haitian society, because of its size and its location. There's no doubt about that.
Mm. And with this, a lot of times, as you already mentioned, in very Western ways. So obviously, in preparation for this episode, you know, I read a little bit into Haiti, watched some documentaries, because I think documentaries in particular are usually a very good way of also discovering the Western bubble. Because at the end of each of these three documentaries I watched, each time it was said, oh, you know, now that we've talked for 45 minutes about the hardships of Haiti and everything that went wrong and so on and so forth, you know, the real path to solution here will be elections. You know, we need to give the faith, like the faith of the country, back into the hands of the people, and they need to hold elections because this will solve everything.
Yeah, it's that insanity, right? It's the idea, first of all, equating elections with democracy, right? Elections are just a practical thing that you do. It has nothing to do with whether a country is democratic or not. Well, very little to do. I mean, democracy is much more than simply holding elections, obviously. But it's also, once again, the outside not understanding that Haiti will never be Switzerland, that Haiti will never be Sweden, Haiti has to be Haiti, and Haiti has to choose its own system, its own politics, but the West doesn't let it, right? So if your argument is, we want stability in Haiti, then that's a very different argument than saying we want stability, but it has to be democratic, it has to be pro-Western, it has to be liberal, it has to be this, it has to be that. Stability is hard enough. Then once you start imposing your own moral framework onto a very fragile society like Haitian society, then that becomes particularly problematic. On top of that, you're imposing ghosts from a traumatic past. You know, you the moment Europeans or even Americans are saying to Haiti, this is what we expect from you, that goes back to those centuries of abuse from outsiders onto Haiti. And again, I like the individual analogy, right? You've been abused in your childhood or in your younger adult years. You're finally free from that abuser. And then the abuser comes by and says, I'm going to paint a room for you. Well, that's probably not a particularly pleasant and good idea. And it's very likely to create new trauma for you.
What's the international relations context?
A lot of this, what we've discussed now in the bubble, reminds me of the book and the paper Why Nations Fail. And I mean, so Haiti is also part of it. I personally never made it to that chapter because that book does get repetitive at some point. But right, so because you have the very nice comparison, you are on the same island, so you have in theory, right, the same standards, the same also in nature, the same environment, same circumstances. But the Dominican Republic is doing better than Haiti. So, something must be wrong here. And then it immediately gets into this talk of, well, you know, Haiti, they're lacking, they're lacking rule of law, they're lacking this, property rights, you know, the typical why nations fail approaches. However, one of the problems, I mean, we can go into the analysis of this, but one of the problems I always felt with why nations fail is, first of all, what's a nation? And second of all, why are we not talking about states? And this very much applies to Haiti here as well. And I think this is going to be also big of a bigger theme in this episode, that I think we need to talk about failed states from a Western perspective, because it is a concept that gets thrown around in the West a lot. And then always, you know, as soon as a Western policymaker hears the term failed state, you know, it gets tingly in their fingertips and they wanna send something there.
Well, especially because they see the opportunity to now, okay, so it's rock bottom, hit rock bottom. Now we can build it up into our own self-image, right? That's the idea. That's been now for decades the belief with Somalia. And ask your average Somalian how that's going. I really like the distinction between nations failing and states failing, because if you talk about a state failing, you can point to very specific Westphalian conditions that the state needs to have. It needs to provide stability. It needs to have a level of political legitimacy. Political legitimacy doesn't mean democratic legitimacy, right? Political legitimacy means that political leadership is recognized as the power representing the Westphalian state. Those things are hard enough, but they are much easier to identify and to work on than a nation failing, which is much broader, which has to do with values, which has to do with culture, which has to do with economics and all that. And it's perfectly possible to have a very poor, horribly authoritarian, dictatorial regime, and the stability being provided by the state, then the state hasn't failed, right? But if your objective is, no, it has to be more than that, we can't just accept a poor authoritarian regime, it has to be a thriving Switzerland, yeah, then you're starting going to mess with all kinds of dynamics that are way too complex to control from the outside. And you're much more likely to actually make things worse than make things better.
A thought I just had when you said, there's a big difference between a state failing and a nation failing. And I think in Haiti, we can clearly talk about a state failing. I mean, right, anyone who has watched the news lately, right, there's lots of gang violence. The government is basically breaking down every few weeks. The current prime minister even went to Kenya asking for support by Kenyan peacekeeping troops. Then he wasn't allowed to return back to the country. Now there's a transitionary council, and so on. Right, so that's a failed state. I think we can all agree on. The way you described a failed nation got me thinking, is the Western bubble a failed nation or a failing nation? Because it's basically, I mean, all the factors that you just listed, I feel like we could tick off to a certain extent in the West.
In the sense that economically, politically, there's that backsliding and things are getting worse. And then the
values, the norms that once made the West so good are now being undermined and forgotten about. And the things that, you know, once actually made the West fail before, right? They are now coming back and gaining more importance. I mean, should we just write a book of why the actual nations, not the states, fail?
Yeah, I think there's an argument to call them failing, right? Not failed, because that would be silly in the sense that, hey, I look out of my window here in Madrid and you look out of your window in Berlin, and people generally do really reasonably well. And you know, there is relative political stability, etc., etc. But and economically things are doing well, but the failing aspect of the West is very clearly available. And if that continues, and there's no reason to assume it doesn't continue, then at some point we're going to wake up in a failed society, a failed nation. There is interesting literature about the importance of having a goal as society, right? Of trying to achieve something as a nation, and however you want to identify the nation, right? Because sometimes people think of nation as ethnocentric or anything like that, but just the group of people within a Westphalian territory, what do they want to achieve together? And what you notice in the West, in Europe certainly, and to a certain extent in the United States as well, is that people no longer have ambitions for the nation. They have ambitions for themselves, but not for where they're going. Instead, they're trying to desperately hang on to what they build up over the past 100 years or so. And so, yeah, I think there's an interesting argument to be made there. But what is very different is that the state hasn't failed yet. The state in Spain, in Germany, is still functioning well. Politics is becoming very fragile, but the state still provides its basic duties. Physical stability, criminals generally get arrested and thrown in jail. There is relative economic safety, et cetera, right?
Absolutely. And to take this back to Haiti a little bit, because I think now we've properly established the difference between a failed state and whatever a failed nation would look like. And I think also established that the West is not a failed nation yet. And it won't be a failed nation if Western policymakers listen to this podcast. But kind of taking back to Haiti, so Haiti is not a failed nation in that sense. Haiti is a failed state, but at the same time, I would want to add something here that, I mean, failed state to me implies that the people on the inside, or, you know, within the state, the people responsible there for the state, that they have failed. Honestly, that's not convincing to me because of what we've discussed in the previous segment, right? That, I mean, I don't think Haiti was necessarily failed by its own people. I think it's more that the international community, particularly the West, failed Haiti.
In your fact sheets, you read out quite a lot of that. The moment they become independent, roughly the Monroe Doctrine kicks in, right? Monroe Doctrine 1823, where the United States essentially says to Europe, stay out of the Caribbean and Latin America. This is our backyard now. And that becomes very clear in the 20th century when Germany has a short period of trying to use Haiti as a diplomatic political base in the region, and the United States essentially then colonizes Haiti. And even after that, after the Second World War, when again Haiti becomes independent, what you see is that they are being thrown about by Western interest. You get a pro-American regime during the Cold War, and afterwards Western forces are trying to establish France geopolitical alliances within Haiti. And therefore, the country never really had a serious chance to choose its own destiny. And that is completely obvious. And it's it seems so clear if you just look at the facts. This doesn't seem like a subjective analysis. This is a factual analysis of what happened to the country. And then for European nations, either through the UN or directly, and the United States, either through the UN or directly, to come into Haiti and say, hey, we see that you're in trouble, we're here to help, seems so insanely counterproductive. It seems so obviously doomed to fail that you have to ask yourself, why do Washington and Paris and London do this?
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
Why do they do this, right? That's a very good question. I think here, when we're now talking about, you know, what's the damage here of that Western bubble? I think first it makes sense to look back a little bit at the best of the worst, right, of what the West did to Haiti. And because you mentioned already, right, I think that we can really only talk about the West trying to save Haiti in the last 100 years, basically since the U.S. intervention. And before, it was just a race of who can exploit Haiti the fastest, right? So you all had...
I should point out that when you say saved Haiti, you were doing air quotes, but our listeners can't see that because obviously, I think that's an important distinction, saving Haiti with air quotes or saving Haiti without air quotes.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. But in the years before, it was basically a race of who can exploit Haiti the fastest, right? So it was either, I mean, through colonization very clearly, or then also right after independence, Napoleon loses Haiti, Napoleon loses a few more things than just Haiti, the monarchy is back in France, and then there's an attempt of France to basically recapture or reconquer Haiti, right? And then the monarchy and the Haitian authorities at that time, right, they kind of negotiate this settlement that in exchange for recognizing Haiti's independence and sovereignty, Haiti has to pay 100 million francs to France, which, I mean, I think roughly now translates to somewhere around 34 billion US dollars. And that's crazy, given that, I mean, that's a crazy amount of money, right? And now this poor country that has done nothing wrong except get its independence has to pay for hundreds of years, because they only finished paying these debt payments to France in 1947. They have to pay basically 80% of their annual budget for the French debt, right? Completely crippling the country and its economy. And then, right, you look at that, and then suddenly, 100 years later, again, big air quotes here, the West is trying to save Haiti, right? And the French are saying, oh, you know what, because we speak the same language, we're going to help you here.
And it's not just a crippling debt. It's not just an economic problem. It is a huge economic problem, a huge financial issue. But on top of that, think about what that then does to leadership. So leadership, they're continuously struggling to make ends meet. You can't get budgets together with that kind of external debt that you're... We've seen this in sub-Saharan African countries that were in a debt spiral as well. You cannot make proper policy completely independently of your intellectual and leadership capabilities. It's just impossible when you have this debt hanging over you. And so what that means is then you either have to turn to large powers on the outside to sort of help you out, at least get interest payments done, or to have some, you know, sympathy for your plight at the IMF or the World Bank. Or you're going to look at criminal connections. You're going to look at illicit ways to generate revenue. So yes, this debt was a huge economic problem, but it also set up Haiti to be basically possibly positioned at a geopolitical level internationally. They needed to desperately do business with whoever who wanted to do business with them to give a little bit of relief, a little bit of easing of their international position. And so you cannot ignore these patterns and then all of a sudden later come in and say, hey, we're here to help you. Obviously, that doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, then you're forced to do business with dodgy parties such as the Germans, which, I mean, it's let me use this opportunity in this podcast and the platform that I have to again look at German history and be surprised at how many places we were doing terrible things, because.
But we're talking post World War One here. Germany wasn't that dodgy then, Dario. Right?
I mean, for me, Germany has always had a dodgy side to it, because then particularly. We're also talking in about the 19th century here, you know, because you mentioned basically the embarrassment and the humiliation to governments, right? That, I mean, the French imposed those payments onto the Haitian government and authorities, basically, right, forcing them into illicit corners, but also taking away any legitimacy. And the Germans did the same, right? When, for some reason, there were German settlers on Haiti at that time, right? Half German, half Creole, half Haitian. And then one of them, looters, basically got arrested for allegedly hitting an officer. And what's the absolutely normal German reaction to this? Well, let's send two warships to the Haitian coast and basically offer an ultimatum and tell them that, hey, you have to release this person and you have to officially apologize and wave a red flag above your parliament for us to not invade your island. I mean, right, this is just a very small example from Haitian history, but to me kind of symbolizes that Haiti is just a little ball in the international arena, and it was kicked around from left to right, and whichever Western power was currently in the area wanted to humiliate it.
And that sets it apart from, let's say, the Pacific Islands, from Tuvalu or any other nation that is so far away from any strategic interest that they still have the ability to choose their own destiny. Haiti, because of its geopolitical location and because of its surroundings and because of the fact that it was created in the very first place by Europeans in its modern form, that it just never had a chance. It just never had a chance to find any kind of ambition for itself. You know, I previously mentioned that nations typically that are successful have a clear goal, have a clear objective, are trying to achieve something. Haiti never had a chance to ask itself what it wanted to achieve because it was always dealing with this deeply problematic and traumatized past.
Mm. And if we cannot go further, especially in these years, that increased German presence on the island obviously made the United States very nervous because, right, hey, this is our backyard, Monroe Doctrine, Europe, stay out of it. Which then prompted the United States to invade Haiti, right? From 1914 to 1934, which, I mean, okay. I mean, I think we now know in today's world that invading another country and basically placing it under your power is not the ideal scenario here.
This was in the time period that the United States was a little bit confused about its own position in the world, right? It started behaving in a way that was no longer consistent with the purpose that the founding fathers had given the nation. So it also did some weird things with the Philippines, for example, and we can discuss those moments. The United States was looking for an identity because it had become the largest power on earth. It had overtaken the British Empire in terms of economic power, at the very least, not so much military power yet. And yeah, then they see Haiti and they say, okay, let's do this. Once again, showing the sort of Eurocentric approach of the United States, the fact that the United States is not a Europe 2.0, but it is basically very much a Western Eurocentric political power that in many ways cannot escape that colonial ideological attitude towards non-Western states.
And particularly that ideological attitude, right? So what do you do if you occupy an island for 20 years? Well, you establish democracy. I mean, you build infrastructure, right? So the United States did invest a lot into Haiti, trying to turn it into a little democracy and making sure that in its backyard there's no Cuba 2.0, basically. And you see that, and they also build up the military of the country. Which now becomes interesting about 60 years later in 1994, because that's when the military in Haiti ousted a democratically elected president, prompting the second U.S. invasion of Haiti. Because, you know, hey, we're going to build your military up, but only if you use it in democratic ways and not if you use it to oust a president. And then during that occupation, the United States basically dissolved the military, making sure that it cannot take over democratic institutions again, which now in turn is one of the many reasons why Haiti is in such a security crisis nowadays, right? And there's increased gang violence, and the central authorities aren't strong enough. So, right, if you're talking about countries in terms of people and persons, right, as we sometimes do, just maybe speak with the younger generation's language here. I mean, the United States is gaslighting Haiti. It's terrible, right? I mean, this must be the most toxic boyfriend anyone has ever had in the history of boyfriends.
Absolutely. I just want to point out here for our listeners that Dario is still in his 20s. So when he talks about talking to the younger generation, he's talking about himself. But he likes to pretend that he's an old man. you know, absolutely. This is so inconsistent, but it fits very much the narrative of history. If you look at the United States in the 1990s, that is the time that they've won the Cold War. They've forgotten about decades and decades of messing about with authoritarian regimes and dictatorships all across the world, especially in Latin America, by the way. And all of a sudden, they have to pretend to be the policemen of everything that is good and proper, namely democracy and liberalism. And so all of a sudden in the 90s, they no longer mess about for pure direct geopolitical control, but they start messing with governments because those governments aren't democratic or liberal enough, with all the horrendous consequences that we've seen since, not just in Haiti, but in many other countries that were subject to that. And the ease with which that is ignored afterwards in the analysis, and the ease with which then a new attempt is made to interfere in that society, is astounding in many ways. And it would be funny if it didn't have such serious consequences for local populations, right? But it would be almost hilarious in the sense of like, well, are you completely blind? Only yesterday you did this and now you're doing it again under a different motto? What the heck is going on here?
Absolutely. And then in more recent history, I mean, we've had the, right, so there was a UN peacekeeping mission since 2004 because of yet another coup d'etat. One of the negative effects of a UN peacekeeping mission can be cholera, right? So basically, just like the European settlers and Columbus in 1492 bringing smallpox, then the peacekeepers brought cholera to the country, killing 10,000 people and a million infected. Right, so that, and then on top of that, right, we see, because this is more the humanitarian type of help, right? Okay, we're helping you with the peacekeepers, they're nice and lovely. And then after the earthquake, the West was also very quick to help with humanitarian aid. And this is the one that we are usually a little bit less critical of. But then we hear stories such as the Oxfam sex scandal.
The Oxfam sex scandal came after the earthquake of 2010 and in 2011. A number of Oxfam people relatively high up in the hierarchy had sex with teenage and even younger girls, and were it's a horrible story, it's close to my heart because it was right at the time that I was escaping the development and humanitarian sector, moving into foreign policy essentially, because I didn't want to be connected to what I'd seen for decades within the development sector. And when people say, yeah, that was really unfortunate that staff of Oxfam committed these abuses and that is horrible, but surely overall you can't blame the West for that, or you can't blame the desire to do humanitarian good. Well, I kind of can. And the reason why I can is because the humanitarian sector and the development sector have very much that colonial identity of, here we are powerful, we're here to help you. In the 16th century it was, we're here to bring Jesus Christ to you, to save you from yourself. Now it is, we're here to bring humanitarian aid to you. But it is still an enormous power imposition from the outside. This is the way we're going to do things. We're here now and you have to listen to us, creating an environment in which this kind of abuse, such as the Oxfam scandal, can occur. And once again, you see a sector and a society in the West that is unaware of itself, of its potential for abuse, of the power imbalance that it is creating in these societies. It's completely ignorant of its own past.
And what now?
So what do we do with failed states such as Haiti or Somalia? I mean, because I've said this in the preparation for this episode. Whenever you read about the hardships that people in Haiti go through or in Somalia go through, right, there is always this little urge of, oh, I want to help. Right? I want to help them somehow. And I don't know if we can do this with humanitarian aid or with interventions or with development aid. But what do we do from a Western bubble perspective? I think, I mean, step one could be apologize. Maybe take responsibility for this, right? Unlike the United Nations, that after they brought cholera, they admitted it, but never really admitted responsibility. So to avoid any payments of reparations. But I think that might be a first step. But what do we do after we admit that we have done terrible to Haiti for the last 400 years? I mean, what do we do then?
It's probably useful to go back to this distinction between the failing state and failing nation, right? It is important for anyone on this globe for the Westphalian system to work, which means that we don't want states to fail. So if our objective is to support this Haitian state to be able to have stability internally and to have relative political legitimacy, then that requires us to take away obstacles to that. What are obstacles to that? Well, one huge obstacle would be debt payments, right? A state cannot function properly if it's continuously there as a vehicle to repay debt to the outside world. It's just not going to happen. Two is not to interfere, not even to care in a certain way about the nature of that state, not to care about whether it's democratic or authoritarian, just to say no, the Haitian population, just like any other population around the world, deserves a stable state, and it is not up to us to determine what kind of ideology that state projects onto its country. And beyond that, yeah, the answer very often is not to do anything, right? We do have, as you rightly pointed out, this tendency to try to make the world a better place and be actively involved in things that we believe are unjust, are wrong. But our involvement too often makes things worse. And so the trick here is to say, all right, this is not up to me. This is not my responsibility. If I am being asked for help by the Haitian state, I will respond to that. But beyond that, I need to be modest. I need to be humble. I need to understand that my desire to help might have horrible counterproductive consequences. Look at the past 300-400 years of Haiti and look at how much Europeans have helped Haiti. So maybe we should simply let Haiti choose its own destiny and not try to know better than the local population does.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on Haiti and the concept of failed states. If you have any questions, comments, regards, or you heard a mistake we made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side, Balder. Which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Noam Chomsky is always a reliable author to go to if we want to be particularly critical of the United States in particular, but also the West in general. the reason why we don't always quote Noam Chomsky is that his work also goes in a direction that we're not always comfortable with when it comes to certain conspiracy thinking. But he has been a very bright mind analyzing international relations, and he wrote, "The two main criminals are France and the United States. They owe Haiti an enormous reparations because of actions of going back hundreds of years. If we could ever get to the stage where somebody could say, 'We're sorry we did it,' that would be nice."